Hi everyone, welcome back to another episode of Enablement Evolved. Today I am joined by someone whose work I have admired from afar. We did actually try and do this pre-Christmas, but then I got sick and then they got sick. So we're actually managing to finally catch up today. Someone I've been looking forward to having on the pod for quite a long while. So this person has been in enablement for a good amount of time. They've done lots of different roles. They've skinned many cats. To give you a bit of background, which we'll dive into, they've been a global program director and a senior enablement manager at Adobe, which is no mean feat. They've been a VP of enablement at a company called Notified. They are now currently the owner, coach, and consultant at philputnam.com. And with a company name like that, it could be none other than Phil Putnam himself. How are you, Phil?
Hello, I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me.
No, it's been a long time coming. So for anyone who's foolish enough not to know who Phil Putnam is, would you mind starting off with a little bit of a background about your journey in enablement and what's brought you all the way up to being at philputnam.com, which is a very unique company name.
I know it's mysterious. Well, I'm basically a therapist that didn't want to go to graduate school.
Nice.
That's really what it comes down to. So, I've always had these two things in my life that have been consistent, even from a very young age, and they are that I'm just a caretaker. Like I just want to take care of people, and also I'm obsessed with communication.
Nice.
So, these two things have threaded throughout everything I've ever done in my career, and I've had a lot of different types of jobs. Even a music career as well as my tech
Nice.
career. But whatever I did was always just an expression of these two things that I still today am so completely obsessed with. And so I was able to do that within SaaS tech and corporate tech for a long, long time, almost 20 years, and really enjoyed it. And I had one relationship with employment that whole time. It was I worked for one company. I was full time in house, and I was bought in. I was like the company man wherever I worked for. And over the years, I just kind of started to realize that that was dumb. That it was just really dumb to make my employer the centerpiece of my life. And I thought, you know what? I think work should serve me. And I think work should just be one component of the life that I live. And I think what work should do for me is it should give me the resources I need to get closer to having the life that I want. And so I sort of just, I can't say that I deliberately initiated this process. I sort of just naturally went through this evolution, over the last few years. And what it did is it really brought me to what has become my signature approach to performance and motivation. And then, I was developing that while I was working for my previous employer. And then they chose to dissolve the entire enablement practice that I ran as a cost-cutting measure. And so I was laid off, in October of 23. And so I decided, you know what? I'm going to take my own advice. I'm going to bet on myself. I'm not going to wait. And I'm going to see what can happen when I, become my own boss. And so currently today, late March of 24, I'm about 6 months into that process. And let me tell you, it's going better than I could have ever imagined. And more importantly, I am more satisfied as a human being than I ever could have imagined.
That's great. And I remember like mid last year, you were already doing some like employment workshops on LinkedIn and stuff like that and helping with that. You know what? I think it's such an important thing. You and I spot like I was laid off not long, like a couple of months after you last year. And I think one of the biggest things, right, is people you even though it's not personal, you take it personally, right? Or you can take it personally. You can see your own self-worth can be checked in your own head, right? Which is a very dangerous thing to do when you're then going to go out and try and talk about how valuable you are to other people, right? I think you and I were talking just before we started a pod, and like I think it's very easy to go from that sort of like suboptimal level of self-worth, and then put promise the world to this future employer, then put that the next employer at the center of your world, right? And then you go, and then you get stuck in that sort of vicious cycle, especially at the moment where people get laid off 2, 3, 4, 5 times in the space of 5, 6 years, right?
Yeah.
And it's and I think for lots of people, like I've been genuinely overwhelmed and blessed by this amazing enablement community. When I said, look, I've been let go, and people reached out, and everybody has tried to help. It's the most amazing community, right? Like,
yeah.
But like, people struggle, right? Like, with that self worth going into or not putting their employer or their career at the center of everything, right?
It strikes, and when we lose that job, it strikes at the core of who we are.
100%.
And you know what's so, it's such a disorienting experience. I went through it myself, you know, and so I've had some time to think through, like, what does make it so confounding? What is so odd about this experience? And it's like you're dealing with this massive threat to your identity. Mm-hmm. You know, you also now have experienced something where the main narrative that the world has around job loss is only that it's your personal failure.
Yeah.
And, you know, when it's you're being laid off, you're not being let go for performance, that doesn't line up, but it's still the way that you're being treated. And so it's the way you treat yourself, because that's what you've learned from the world around you. Mm-hmm. But then on top of it, you're dealing with like these massive human emotions, like grief, betrayal, anger, embarrassment. I mean, at like operatic levels, you know, like it's high drama, and that's your reality. And then at the same time, if you don't have the fortune of being able to wait for a while before you have to go find your next job, you then have to present yourself as this fully capable, satisfied person. And you have to do this without even the faintest whiff of a chip on your shoulder to these recruiters who are so overwhelmed that they're just begging for a reason from you to disqualify you from the process, right?
Yes.
So this particular era of looking for an enablement job is so demanding in such unique ways. And that's what really brought me to want to just serve that particular topic in our community over the past year, is because, first of all, nobody was talking about it.
Yes.
Which shocked me, because
everyone was going through it though, right? But no one was talking about it.
And I'm not just talking about enablement. I mean, like, a lot of fields were going through massive job loss globally, but nobody was talking about it. And so I thought, well, I've always been the person who will be mouthy, you know? But I kind of can't help myself from putting my finger right where the pain is.
Sure.
That's always kind of been the person that I am. And I'm willing to sacrifice for the sake of soothing other people's pain. And so I just thought, you know, this is, our industry has been wounded.
Yes.
And it's both fair and unfair, and it's both understandable and incomprehensible, and it's inhuman and human. And so I just had to find a way of interacting with that that could potentially increase people's peace of mind. And that's really my entire ethos, to be honest. Everything I do, whether I'm coaching an individual client or I'm advising a company as a GTM consultant or I'm teaching a workshop, everything I do is designed to increase peace of mind. Because if you can increase someone's peace of mind, you can actually, you can actually improve the quality of their life.
100%. And just to touch on one of the things you mentioned, like, and I had this conversation offline with, you know, peers of mutual friends of both you and I, like, I wasn't embarrassed by how I left my last company. I still find it tough to tell people I'd left. I still found it tough to put the old green banner on. I don't know why. Like, I had conversations with people, but I spoke to other people and they felt the same.
Yeah.
Right, and then they went first and then I went, and it was almost like a calculated thing. But the thing is, it was like, I don't know why, right? And I think, again, it goes back to lots of those things you talk about. Like, it's just happened. It's very raw. You know that when you put that up, whether it's the green banner or whether it's telling people your life, you know you're going to have to answer some kind of question.
Of course.
Even if those were positive questions. Like, I had most of the outpouring of messages I got were all about, how can I help?
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, I didn't know. How can you help? What did you say? Find me a job? You know, like, it was really difficult. And also, like, you can't, sometimes you can't see the wood for the trees, to your point when you're right in that sort of madness of that initial sort of period.
Yeah.
And I took a 2 month break before I said to anybody. And even
That's
then, I still
smart.
felt it, right? Like, I still felt it then.
Yeah. Well, of course, and like when people, eventually enough people ask you, how can I help? And what you really want to say to them is like, give me money.
Oh,
but you can't do
send
that.
me
Here's my Venmo. Put your money
Venmo.
where your mouth is. But no, like, I think that you raise a really good point. And I, at least for me, I felt that embarrassment too, not so much in this case, because in this case, I was fortunate to have the ability to build my own company. So I do not take that for granted. But I've lost my job 3 times now in my career. And the 2 times before this recent layoff, I got fired for performance, right? But I will tell anybody that. And the reason why is because job loss is a part of almost everyone's journey, and failure is a part of everybody's employment experience. And so I very deliberately talk about my failures, particularly with my career, so that I can just make other people feel a little less self-conscious about processing their challenges, however they want to process them. Like, you don't have to tell people about your job loss if you don't want to, but you can also know that the message that the world sends us, that any type of job loss is in some way your personal failure, that message is just a lie. It's just a lie. And I'm going to talk about my failures as openly and as joyously and humorously as possible, because they're just normal. They're just organic to the human experience. And so that's a lot of what motivates me and how I interact with this topic.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things we're going to talk about. You know, the main thing we're going to talk about is sort of performance and how to get that performance. And you've maybe touched on a little bit now in terms of diving into that, because I know that you've got such a passion for getting maximum or helping people get the maximum performance out of themselves. Where does that passion come from? Does it come from those failures that you've gone through, or does it come from somewhere else?
It comes from bad managers, honestly. But I'm gonna reframe it a little bit, because the truth is, getting top performance out of people is not my primary passion. My primary passion is helping people get what they want out of their work experience, that helping people have the relationship with employment that they most want to have. And then, as a result of that, top performance becomes a natural result of the fundamental motivation that gets produced. So it's this chain reaction that I believe in, where at the core, we as people, we do not work in order to give our employers our top performance. That's not what we're motivated by the most. I think that we're motivated by that, but that's not what we want most out of work. What we want most out of work is to have our job bring us closer to getting the life that we want. And when we can see that real material connection between the job we have and the life we want, we are going to be fundamentally motivated to bring our employer our top performance with a minimal amount of friction in getting there. And the reverse is true. When we realize that the job we have is not a pathway to the life we want, we disengage, our performance dips, and if it's not fixed by a supportive and savvy manager, we will eventually attrit. And our employer then will be saddled with the bill of replacing us, which is hundreds of thousands of dollars per person. So everybody, employer, employees, managers, we've all got really, really good reasons, financial and emotional reasons, to really center what motivates the employee most as the heart of performance. But what I've seen most often, with other leaders, and then how I've been treated by leaders, is they try to motivate my performance, or anyone's performance, excuse me. They try to, so that's classy.
I mean, it's right on par for this podcast, to be fair.
Maybe Maybe you'll edit out my belch. I don't know. We'll see.
Never.
But okay, good. You know, everybody Never. Belches. Everybody belches, Kieran. People lose jobs and they belch. Deal with it, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
What, people use a chain reaction.
Oh my God. Phil Putnam out here just smashing stereotypes. Okay. But what I'm trying to say is that every manager I've ever had, they try to motivate me to perform better or like extend my tenure or work longer by saying, look at how important you are to our company's success.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's why you should devote yourself more. And the thing is, like, I do care if my employers succeed, but it's not what I care about most. It's not why I work. And so trying to make a person's proximity to the company's success the engine of their motivation is never going to give you the best possible performance results.
Sure.
What will give you the best results is saying, okay, hey person, tell me about the life you want to have. Mm-hmm. Like, describe to me what you want. And then if I'm your leader, I'm going to look at that and I'm going to analyze, okay, like, what would I need to be able to provide for them to produce this life experience as a result of them working this job? And then I'll be able to tell, okay, they either can get that from this job in a reasonable amount of time, meaning the next 2 to 3 years max, or they're not going to get that. Like, I know my company, I know we're cheap, or this person needs to be able to relocate and we don't offer this role in the place where they need to relocate to. Like, there are just some real fundamental material things you can identify. And what's great is, as a people leader, then you have advance notice. You can plan. And if you're honest with yourself and you're honest about why people work in the first place, you can be like, okay, like, I can't give Kieran what he wants from this job. So I need to anticipate that I'm going to lose him in the next 2 to 3 years, unless I can find a way to give him what he wants. And therefore I can plan. I can plan on losing him, or I can plan on keeping him if I can find a way to do it. Right. And there's just so many benefits to all parties in the situation when you center the employee's desires as the heart of motivation.
Yeah. Now I want to dive in how you diagnose that, but the thing that kept coming into my brain when you're going through that, Phil, you're a very profound gentleman. And you and I had a brief chat, obviously, before we hit the record button. Realistically, how many people do you think know the answer to those questions? Like, in terms of what's, or how many people are actually thinking about, what life do I want and how can I unlock that through my job, especially within enablement? Like, it's a little bit more clear cut in sales, right? Because in sales you go, if I do X amount of sales, I can get X amount of money and I can buy X house. It's a little bit different in enablement, right? Where it's lots of people move into it for skill set or passion or whatever. And to be, like, I suppose, open from my side, if you had have asked me that maybe 2 years ago, what do you want from your career? To be the best. Just to be the best. Now, I don't not actually know what that means, right? Now, now I do, because I've gone through the process and I do well from achievement. I do well from these things. But it took me a long time to get there. So realistically, how many people do you think know the answer to their own questions?
So to be honest, I have never encountered a single person that could not answer the questions.
Maybe they're just not asking them of themselves in that case.
Well, the variable becomes the level of depth and the level of detail that they can answer them at the start of the conversation. But I think every single human, we have a picture of the elements of the life that we want in our head, right? So, like, if I was talking to you and I said, hey, what do you want? And you said, I want to be the best. What I might say next is, okay, well, tell me, when you imagine being the best, tell me a couple experiences. Like, what are you doing that expresses the best? And I would have you maybe describe to me behaviors that you imagine, or scenarios you imagine yourself being in. And you would just start describing to me what you pictured, how you imagined yourself behaving as the best. And then I would say, okay, great. And then what do you think being the best would do for your life? Like, what would it bring into your life? What would you expect it to bring into your life. And then you might start talking about compensation. You might start talking about flexibility, mobility, recognition. You might start talking about how being the best makes you feel. And then you might start talking about how changing the way that you feel about yourself and your life changes mm-hmm. your idea of what you can accomplish in the first place.
Yeah.
And it just starts, it's like this concentric circle that just keeps expanding. I've never met a single person that when you approach them with the essential message that what you want matters, that they're not interested in that conversation.
No, I think that's a great way of framing it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think to your point, like my answer would be quite flippant until mm-hmm. I had someone who could guide me through that conversation. Right. And I think
let me ask you this. What do you think are the reasons why your first response would be flippant?
Well, interestingly, I've pontificated on this a lot. Mm-hmm. I come from a very high performance background. As I say, mm-hmm. I played professional sport as a kid. And if you weren't the best, you weren't anything, right? So mm-hmm. that's what I'm saying. For me, it was like very flippant. I grew up playing for the sort of biggest club in my country. And it was, you were very much had all the pressure on you. Like, if you don't want this, there's 1,000 boys that do. Mm-hmm. Right? So you couldn't have a bad training session. You couldn't have this. So that's what I'm saying. Like, I understand that my answer would be flippant to be the best. Why? Because if you, as I say, my you know, nature versus nurture, I'm very competitive by nature. But the nurture element was if you weren't that, then you were. Yeah. There would be nothing. So as I say, like the flippant, is there something in the answer, the flippant answer? Yes. But to your point, there wouldn't be as much depth in it until someone was guiding me through that conversation. And again, that comes from it's like a knee-jerk reaction of that's my default answer, right? It that always has been.
So was it like, because what I'm hearing is like a combination of exceptionalism and scarcity. Like you're replaceable, right?
Yeah, both. Yeah, which is a massive dichotomy of emotion, right? Whereas like everyone's telling you you're special, but you're not that special, you know? Because you're obviously you're elite, but you're not. The scarcity is there are still 1,000 people that can. Now, was there 1,000? Who knows? But that's the sort of stick that you're beating with at the time. So yeah, it's a massive like tumultuous dichotomy of emotions that you're put through all the time, and again. I think when you become a little bit more mature or when you get to our vintage, I won't say our age, I'll say our vintage in life, I think that there's a lot more nuance to that. Like to your point, your version of success or your definition of success might be different from mine, or the best might be different. My knee-jerk was the best.
Well, and you know, here's the thing, like I a lot of people, their first response is kind of flippant or defensive or humorous. Yeah. I mean, I often will first respond with humor just because it's a defense and coping mechanism. Cool. But what I've found with a lot of people is that they don't even know that they're allowed to want something.
Oh, yeah.
They don't even know that they are allowed to be the center of their relationship with employment.
Yeah.
And that for a lot of us, who do define ourselves by our output, whatever it is, and define our worth by our output, that's a huge identity shift. And it's a very, very terrifying proposition to change your thinking from I earn my keep as a human, like my right to exist is based upon my ability to produce, to go from that mindset to saying, I could literally sit on my couch and produce not a single thing for the rest of my life, and I would still have worth as a human.
Yeah.
That's terrifying.
Oh,
and so what I tend to find is that people have a relationship with employment where they don't even know that they are allowed to prioritize themselves. And, you know, there's a lot of character value that is associated with loyalty to an employer.
Yeah.
Where I think that breaks down though, and why it doesn't work for people of our vintage and younger vintages is because, I'm about to turn 45. I'll turn 45 in July of 2024. I was born in July 79. So my parents were baby boomers. Right. So my parents are from the generation that is the epitome of the loyalty to an employer generation. And that was a part of your character you were not seen as a good person in their generation if you didn't have solid, stable, long-term employment. However, there were elements of that drove loyalty that were provided to an employee by an employer in their generation, like pensions, like unions, like legitimate retirement savings, you know, contributions from your employer that no longer exist for us today.
Yeah.
Right. I have never worked in an industry that provided a pension. I have never worked in an industry that's unionized. I have never had a 401k matching program that wasn't a fucking joke. And so we have this cultural inheritance of loyalty as a part of what makes you a good person, loyalty to an employer. But the things that would fuel that loyalty coming to us from an employer haven't existed in our entire working history.
Yeah.
And so we're stuck between this expectation that we inherited from our history and this reality that in no way supports that expectation. And it makes it a difficult thing for people of our generation to really navigate through what place they're going to put employment in their life.
Yeah. No, I mean, I identify with lots of it myself, and I know other people do. And yeah, that's interesting. So, I mean, just to move back, I know I took you off on a little bit of a tangent there to you know, the maximum performance.
Mm-hmm.
If you're working, obviously you've been parts of teams, but if you're working with someone and when performance issues arise, what is your approach to sort of diagnosing what the problem actually is, the performance issue actually is, and going about solving that?
Well, let's do a little bit of table setting first. So I'm going to lay out kind of the two primary concepts that I work from. The first is that people do not work to make their employer successful.
Hmm.
They work to get the life they want, right? And if your goal, and so they do care about making their employer successful, but what they want most is to get the life they want. So if you need to establish the most reliable basis for long-term top-level performance, your best bet, your most logical bet, is to base that performance on what the person wants most, not just on something that they want. So that's the first concept. The second concept is that what is going to bring performance out of somebody is an individual solution. Yet in almost every case, when an employer tries to solve performance problems, they try to do it on a group or scaled level.
Yeah.
And that's because they are addicted to efficiency as a pathway to controlling cost. But you will never solve the true challenge of motivating performance if you do not have a way to discover what motivates the individuals on your team.
Yeah.
Now, the good news is I've come up with a way of diagnosing and identifying the pathway to individual motivation that is easily scalable. So I can talk you through that. But those are the two principles I work from, is that base it upon what somebody wants most, which is to get the life they want from the work they do, and do not pursue scaled solutions for individual problems.
Yeah, I really like that. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, like, I think back to my time as, like, a people leader. And I think in some occasions I've probably done that well. In some occasions I've completely ignored it, you know, in terms of understanding the people that I work with. And I think I've always had, quote-unquote, close relationships with people that I've had on my team. And I think something I did at my last company, in terms of, like, this, it was almost like two or three teams that had been amalgamated into one.
Mm-hmm.
And we had, like, X amount on sales enablement, X amount on CS enablement, but they didn't really know what each other did, even though they kind of knew who each other were. And we did even just like a little bit, it was like, what's your why? You know, like, what's one thing you want to achieve? What's a bucket list thing? Like, what one thing you would improve on the team?
Yeah.
And I think what that did is it just gave me like a quick snapshot, but it gave me a jumping off point for the next sort of one-to-ones.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I found out someone on my team, they wanted to move to the US. They were based in Germany, they wanted to move to the US. And then when it got like 6 months later into the sort of growth talks going in, I could then be like, oh, and I brought it up, which again, I think solidified that sort of relationship. And you know, oh, they did listen all those months ago. And then we were trying to make it happen. And unfortunately I left, but I think sometimes even some of the things that you're talking about, because they sound quite philosophical and quite profound, but they don't have to be difficult, right? To open up the door to have the, and it's just a conversation at the end of the day, right?
Literally a conversation. And you know what blows my mind? It's just solution selling.
Yes, 100%.
It's just solution selling, but applied to an employee. Or you can also apply it to yourself, right? Because like I'll talk you through the discovery model here in just a second. It's very easy to verbally describe, but an individual can run it on themselves to discover if they have the likelihood of getting the life they want from the job they have, or a leader can run it with their direct reports. And the thing is that when you really boil it down, what a professional's, what an employee's responsibility is to a company, to an employer, is to increase revenue and decrease cost. That's it, right? Now, if you work within the revenue organization and you're a people leader, you're responsible to do both. You need to fuel profit by realizing revenue at a lower overall cost. But specifically, you need to be able to help drive revenue by reducing or drive profit by increasing revenue and reducing attrition cost. And the greatest cost that most companies pay is talent acquisition and headcount replacement, right? So, and if you're working your ass off to generate revenue for your company, but you're just fucking it up by alienating your employees and losing people and having to replace them, you're just burning off all of your revenue with your cost and you're damaging your profit. It makes no sense. So here's how I do it. It's just a conversation. It's a conversation with yourself or between an employee and a manager. And what I want is I want details. So it's about discovery. Okay. So all I do, like you and I were going to have this conversation, I would say, Kieran, hey, do me a favor. I'm going to ask you some questions and I just want you to describe to me the vision of the life you're trying to get in four key areas: lifestyle, money, work experience, and emotional experience. And so I'd start off by saying, hey, like, where do you want to live in 2 to 3 years from now? Is it the house you're in now? Is it somewhere different? Is it in a different city or a different country? I'd ask you about who do you want to live there with? Who's there with you, right? How do you spend your time? And I would listen for how you answered the questions. I would listen for, are you describing basically the experiences and the relational interactions that you have inside your home? Or are you describing objects, aesthetics, design? So basically, are you more satisfied by the way your home impacts your life inside of yourself or outside of yourself? Really good sources of insight. And also, my number one effective discovery question for all of this is describe your couch. It's wacky, but it is like a gold mine of insight.
Really? How come?
Well, let's do it. Let's play the describe your couch game.
Sure.
You game?
I'm
Okay.
in.
Describe your couch.
If it was just for me and I didn't have to listen to my wife.
No, I'm saying describe the actual couch that you have right
On
now.
my actual couch right now. So I have a three seater and a two seater, so like a suite. It is black velvet, right? I didn't choose it. I'm
Okay.
just that's this
That's
is what I
great. Awesome. Okay. Black
yeah
velvet, two seats.
and it has white cushions and like a white fur throw over it.
It's like a domino.
Yeah.
Nice.
Totally.
Okay. And clarify for me, is it two seats, three seats? How big is it?
I've got both. I've got a three seat and a two seat.
Okay. And how long have you had it?
2.5 years. Two
Okay.
years. Two years.
Okay. And like, where is it in your house?
I have one directly in front of the TV because I'm a man. And I've
Sure.
got
Totally.
one off to the side. So yeah, I've got like the three seaters on against the back wall facing the fireplace and the two seaters on the left-hand side of the living room.
And they're like in your family room or your living room.
In
Okay.
the living room.
And then when you're on your couch, what are you doing besides watching TV?
On my phone.
Okay. And then who's there with you usually?
My wife, and depending on the time of the day, my children. Oh,
Okay.
my 9 month old will be on the floor, very rarely on the
Oh,
sofa.
Okay, got it. And then are you guys interacting with each other? What are you doing, you know, when you're on the couch together?
Yeah, normally chatting away.
Cool. Awesome. And then what condition is the couch in? Good, stained, destroyed?
Considering I have a 5-year-old who was three when we bought it and a 9-month-old, pretty good shape, to be fair. Like, not
stained. Good.
Yeah, pretty good shape.
Is it because you've cleaned it a lot?
No, I just threaten my children with violence if they drop it.
I shouldn't laugh at that, but you got me.
Yeah, okay. I mean, yeah, it's just a joke, right? Lol.
Sure, yeah. We do not condone domestic violence.
No.
Okay, so tell me if some of these things might be accurate.
Right.
So it sounds to me like you maybe place a higher priority on the relationships rather than the object itself. Like what you do on the couch rather than the couch itself.
Agreed.
Okay, got it. Also, the fact that it's sort of in like the social heart of your home indicates to me that that's also a higher priority for you.
Yes.
So is it accurate to say that your home for you is primarily a container in which the most cherished relationships in your life are conducted and developed?
Yeah, that's where all my favorite people live.
Okay. And then do you place a lower priority maybe on like the design, how your home looks, how much it costs?
I struggle to answer that because I have no input whatsoever.
Okay.
Which couch we buy, which sofa we buy. I would not have bought the sofa. However, it's comfy. It's fine. Like, my wife doesn't have bad taste. It's just my taste. But yeah, I'm not overly bothered. Like, if she bought something else, I wouldn't care. Right. Like,
okay. So here's what this tells me about, if I was your leader, this is the insight I might gather from your answers to my couch questions. I need to make sure that if I'm going to motivate you by giving you the life that you want from the job that you have, I need to not have the job get in the way of your family. That's the first thing. So I need to be particularly careful about a work-life balance, hours, and locations. If I'm going to ask you to take things that would normally be dedicated as family time and use them as work time, I'm going to have to give you a really solid business reason if I'm going to expect you to respond positively. If I had to make a trade-off between giving you a really big raise every year and between making sure that I don't mess up your work-life balance, I could probably cheat a little more on the, I could probably favor the work-life balance side. Because it sounds like you value that as a form of currency in partnership with money.
Yeah.
Okay.
I would say certainly no.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So let me expand on this a little bit then. So say that you are one of 7 team members that I manage. And let's say that I've run this model on all 7 of them. And what I've discovered is that 3 of your team members do care very, very greatly about salary escalation. Right. Mm-hmm. 4 of them, including yourself, are more along the lines of what you've expressed, which is that work-life balance is extremely important just based upon where you're at in your life right now, young children, family, etc. So what I can use that information as is that when annual salary increase time comes around and the overlords of the company hand me a pile of money to distribute among the 7 people, and of course, the overlords think it's like a treasure. And I'm like, this won't even buy a latte, but I've got to do something magical with it anyway.
Yeah.
I don't have to worry about giving all 7 of you a pretty crappy raise and therefore dissatisfying all of you. Mm-hmm. I can be a little more strategic and I can say, okay, what I know is that I can give Kieran all of the work-life balance he wants. And I can probably even go further with that for him and for the other 4 people. I have to give them a salary increase because they've earned it. But if I make sure that I really emphasize and increase their work-life balance, that's probably going to motivate their performance in the way that I need. Yeah. And then I can give a larger financial increase to these other people this year because they've earned it and they need it to be satisfied. And so what it starts to do is it starts to not only let you know how to handle each individual, but also if you're a leader, it helps you make better strategic decisions with what is most likely going to be limited resources.
Yeah. I love that. You almost covered the next question I was going to ask around the keys to motivating people to care about their own performance and maximizing their own performance. And I think you've kind of touched on that in terms of you just kind of need to understand what's in it for them or why they're doing anything. But is there anything else you would add to that?
Yeah, there is. It's never just about money. And it's never just about money alone. Like, there's this constant, you know, mantra we hear that people are money motivated and that especially sellers, they're coin operated. I don't agree. Okay. I think that nobody works to just get paid. People work to get paid an amount that will actually bring them closer to the life they want.
Sure.
So that's an important distinction. But on top of that, let's say you're making a huge amount of money or even a satisfying amount of money, but you're miserable. So you know what? The way that your job impacts your life, whether your job is a pathway to the emotional experience, the peace of mind that you have, the physical health that you have, all of that matters even more than the money.
Yeah.
And so if you are not looking at lifestyle, money, work environment, and emotional environment, you're not looking at the whole picture. Mm-hmm. And I find that leaders or employers that only focus on, are we giving people the money that they want? They're taking a very employer-based view of employment when they think, well, if we just pay them the right amount, that'll motivate their performance.
Mm.
But cheap inputs make weak outputs.
Yeah, 100%.
So, and you can't be cheap on the money, but you also can't be cheap on the overall experience that you're delivering, because really, that's where we're going to make those decisions. And you know, once somebody reaches the point of self-respect, where they decide that no job is worth my health.
Yeah.
No job is worth the sacrifice of my relationship with my children or whoever I call family. No job is worth X, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Then, yeah, you're going to, as an employer, you're going to have to work harder to keep that person.
Mm.
And if they're worth it, they're going to be worth it to keep.
Yeah. 100%. I think even on that, that resonates with me personally on two different things. Like, the reason I moved from sales leadership to enablement was because I was miserable.
Mm-hmm.
And I got paid significantly more in sales leadership than I do. Significantly, probably double, if not more. Mm-hmm. But I was miserable. And I think it was my wife, and I've told the story multiple times, but it was my wife that said to me, "You're not enjoying this, are you?" I was like, "Yeah, but I don't think anyone is, or anyone does." And she was like, no, they do. I was like, "Do they though?" She was like, "Yeah." And I was like, "Ah, okay, maybe I'm doing it wrong." So she was the person that sort of went, "Well, if you're not enjoying it, why don't you look at something else?" And that's what started my sort of pivoting into enablement.
This is one of my favorite pieces of advice to give to people, is really kind of what you just expressed. And it happened to me as well. I've been with my current partner for 7 years, but I was with another partner a long time ago for 7 years as well. And that was back in my 20s and early 30s. And I had the classic nightmare boundaryless early stage startup experience. And I did not have the self-confidence to have reasonable boundaries. And so eventually, one day my ex looked at me and he was like, "I hate your job and you and you need to figure it out, because I'm not here for this." Like, and so one of my biggest pieces of advice to people is, when your loved ones say they hate your job, listen to them.
Oh, 100%.
They are helping you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
My last place, I didn't particularly enjoy that either, but there was like a certain phrase that I kept coming down and saying, and my wife was like, "I'm sick of hearing this phrase. I'm sick of hearing this." And she didn't work there, right? Like, so she was like, "Why do I know about this?" And I think that's also like a little bit of a boundary that's crossed when you work from home, right?
Because
you don't have that commute to get out of your system. So I'd come down in rant mode. You know, I'd just come off like a difficult call. I'd come down and I'd be like, "And let me fucking tell you about this." And then she'd be like, "I don't care." And I'd be like, well, why do you not care? Because obviously I'm still in work mode, right? I'm like, this is so important to me. This is life or death for me. Why do you not care? Not realizing that I'm in my kitchen, like, shouting. Yeah,
exactly. Well, and it's such a good point, though. Like, you know, there's been a couple times where I have also said to my partners, look, I'm going to be here for you on this, but I literally have nothing else to contribute to this conversation. I said, so I need you to stop bringing this to me until you have something new to tell me. Like, until you have solutions, like, I can't do this anymore. Yeah. Like, and I feel like crap that I can't give you everything that you needed every moment, but also that was never my job as your partner. Sure, that's the reality. Yeah. But also, I just don't have anything more to say. Like, you either need to change the situation or you need to move on. Yeah. Like, that's it. That's where we're at. And I found that in those times, that was the most helpful thing I could have done for that person is just say, I'm no longer on board for this.
Yes.
So figure it out or find a new scenario. That's all I've got.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. That resonates with me. Or my wife, I'd come down and I've said this to my wife before. I'm like, are you going to keep complaining to me about it? Are you going to tell them, right? Like, you need to make something happen, because otherwise I can't fix your problem. I quite literally don't work there. You know that I don't work there. But I want to get to the crux of this, right? Because this is a huge gray area for lots of people who'll be listening to this pod. And it's something that I found myself pondering a lot, because I was put in these positions. And that is, what role do you believe enablement teams should play in performance management and improvement of the wider revenue org? Because this is a huge gray area for me. And I think everyone seems to have a different opinion.
If people could see my face right now, it looked like I just smelled a fart.
or maybe a belch.
Okay, well, that's hitting a little close to home there. Here's what I would say. I'll answer the more tactical question first. Should enablement be actively involved in PIPs, like performance improvement plans? Absolutely not.
Okay.
Absolutely not. Here's why. First of all, if the PIP is not for an enablement person, if it's for somebody who's, you know, in the revenue organization, enablement is not chartered or given the authority to tell anybody what to do.
Great.
Like, I could be the chief learning officer, whatever it is. I could be C-level. It's still not my place to tell a BDR or an account executive or a frontline manager, et cetera, literally what to do. That is their manager's job. Mm-hmm. And a PIP, first of all, PIPs rarely work. Secondly, first of all, let's be honest. But the mechanism that animates them, that gives them any hope of succeeding, is authority, is enforcement. And so the primary curator of the PIP experience must be equipped with the authority to tell the person whose performance has to improve what to do and when to do it. The other reason, first of all, not having somebody in that management chain, it's just not effective for the person who's trying to be rehabilitated. And it gives them a horrible experience. Yeah. And it's not fair to them. PIPs are already hard enough.
Yeah.
Second of all, I think that anytime you use enablement to enforce compliance, you are damaging the chances that enablement will be able to impact revenue in the way it's intended to. Because an account executive knows you don't have the authority as an enablement person to tell them what to do. So they're very rightly going to be like, fuck off. Like, I'm not going to do what you tell me.
Yeah.
But the damage really is done to the enablement person then, because what it does is it erodes trust.
Agreed. Yeah.
And this is one of my favorite phrases I use. You know, lost trust is like rust on a useful tool. Mm-hmm. If enough rust builds up, the tool becomes inoperable. You can't use it. So that's why I'm very adamantly against anybody who's not in the management chain of a person on a PIP being part of that PIP.
Sure.
What was the other? But there was another version of that question you asked. What was it?
It was just around what role, if any, do you believe enablement could, stroke, should play in general performance management? So you've got the PIP, which is obviously very official, very formal. It's got a timeline, but overall, in terms of just if you're like a rep facing enablement person, what
Sure.
role do you think that the enablement could, stroke, should play
Okay.
in if anything?
Well, here's how I look at it. And it's kind of informed by the fact that I used to work in PR. I used to run a publicity firm in my 20s. So if someone is having a performance problem, it's kind of like a, excuse me, it's like a business crisis.
Yes.
You're now in a crisis mode, and you will be in that crisis mode until you have regained the proper standard of operations, right? And if you don't, you lose your job. That's a PIP. I think where things really get off track is when you try to create crisis solutions for the crisis scenario. And the thing is that if a seller is not performing properly, it means they're not getting sufficient results from standard activities in their role. So if the enablement practice is properly aligned already with what the team needs in order to succeed, there actually should be nothing new, nothing custom that enablement should need to provide to get that person off a PIP. And
No.
that's why if a revenue leader came to me and said, "Oh my God, we've got this person and we've got X percentage of our people on PIPs, it's a huge problem. So you need to create custom programming to help them get off PIPs." The first thing I would tell that person is, "No, I won't be doing that."
Yes.
Because being on a PIP does not mean that you're failing at some specialized thing. It means you're just not producing from the standard activities of your job. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to reiterate the standard training for the standard activities, and then I'd probably supplement it with some coaching for those individuals. That's going to be my approach, but it's so tempting to say crisis problem, crisis solution. No. I think the right template for enablement's contribution to solving performance problems is crisis problem, standard solution.
I like that. So I, as I said, every person I've spoken to about this has a slightly different answer in terms of where the responsibility lies. And I think that's because there isn't, no one really knows if enablement should be involved, but quite often we are. I think I've been involved. So we used to do rep reviews at the end of every quarter at a company that I, one of the companies I worked at, and we were invited in, or I was invited in as the sort of the head person on the enablement team to give my opinion on said reps. Now quite often they would differ from, but frustratingly, I often had more detail and depth than their own frontline managers did, which is obviously a problem in itself. But what would happen is we wouldn't call them a PIP, we'd call them a coaching plan, and then enablement was actually responsible for following through, right? So we would, so my role would then be I had to meet with them, so I had to put in like enablement recommendations. And then I had to individually meet with everyone on a coaching plan once a week, and I had to coach them, not their manager, individually. Or and that's for the group that I looked after. And then someone on my team looked after a different role, and they had to do that. And again, I was lucky in that instance that I was really close to all the reps because I started as an IC, so I was working with all the AEs, so it was actually quite easy. My other colleague who never was never close to the reps. She really struggled because then, to your exactly to your point, enablement would turn up and they'd be like, "What are you doing here? Right? Like, why am I listening to you?" Because the relationship between that department and enablement was not as good as it was in other places, and it just didn't work. But also, it wasn't my job to go once a week and meet with four different people or however many at the end of that quarter. I didn't have the time to do that, right? And it was my fault if they didn't pass the coaching plan. And I was like, "No." So.
I'm not trying to insult what you did, though it's going to sound like I am. I'm not insulting you. I'm just insulting your ridiculous behavior. your terrible strategy. No, I have so many problems with what you just described. But first and foremost, I think what the problem is, again, if you're on a PIP, it's because you're not getting the proper results from your existing set of responsibilities. And the first thing that most leaders do is to say, okay, we're going to add a different angle or a different version of those responsibilities to you. They add complexity.
Yes.
Right off the bat. That's a terrible thing to do to somebody. And also, when you're told you're put on a PIP, you go into survival mode.
Of course.
As a human, because you know your job is on the line, no matter what kind of crappy positioning people try to put around it. No, like, you do this or you get fired. That's what it is.
Yeah.
And so it also takes a very specific type of coach to be able to navigate somebody out of survival mode and into a mindset that has a chance of being productive. Mm-hmm. And so if you're adding complexity and equipping them with a poorly skilled coach for that specific task, you're just begging for them to fail.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of strategic thought that needs to be applied to, you know, how do we actually generate success through performance improvement plans? And what I tend to find, honestly, and I'm always honest about what I find, is that most companies don't want positive outcomes from PIPs.
Agreed.
They just run them so that they can fire this person. And when they do, they have grounds to object to a wrongful termination lawsuit.
Yeah, 100%.
But they're not actually invested in bringing this person back to top performance. Because if they were, they would take a much more thoughtful approach to about how to make it successful.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Now, Phil, that brings us towards the end of mm-hmm. a fantastic episode. We've covered lots here. And mm-hmm. I think the work that you're doing is amazing. I think that it's stuff that everyone needs to hear because we need to shift that mindset. But before we finish off the episode, if people want to find out more about what you do, the services that you offer, just pick your brain on some of these things, where's the best place for them to reach out or get in contact with you?
Podcastbelch.com. No. Or if that doesn't work.
Yes.
God, if that's a real website, I actually don't know. Don't blame me for whatever is on that because I have no idea. No, philputnam.com is where I'm at. And if you're looking for coaching, I just start with like a free 45-minute chat. So that's a good way for us to get to know each other on the coaching side. And then, you know, I live on LinkedIn. I love it. I genuinely love it. Like it's such a great way to meet people and learn and help people. Yep. And so LinkedIn, you know, DM me. I'm always very, very responsive.
Wonderful. Well, that brings us to the end of another episode of Enablement Evolved. Thanks a lot for your time, Phil.
My pleasure.